Hello, everyone, and thank you for inviting me here. It's great to be here. Hey, great to see old friends and new faces both. I looked at the content and topic for this evening, and I thought to myself, maybe we should raise hands and supply some jokes about halfway through. This is serious stuff we're about to jump in on. But that's all right. That's what yoga really allows us to do once in a while in our lives, is to take a look a little deeper than we normally do. And let's see how it all turns out in the end. What I would like to do, though, is just make an offer that if you think that you have a question that would interrupt the flow of the talk, interrupt it anyway, because that way we can make sure we catch things as we go along. Otherwise, we'll just dive in and see how it goes. This is a talk about a philosophy. Already that throws most of us a little bit to the wind because we don't talk philosophy too much. When was the last time you went online to check out a philosophy article versus the last time you went online to check out some medical information or some recent news event? We're intrigued with technology, with the digital technology, and we're also intrigued with some of the content there, although not all of it. So it is a little bit of a dive in a new direction for us, and still it's an important direction, one that we all have to come back to at some point or another, one that answers or asks a lot of questions, and the scope of Sankhya philosophy is big. First of all, it's one of six yoga, or it's not yoga, it's one of six philosophies in India. Ancient India, even up into the mid-Common Era, that's around 400, 500, 600 AD, developed in six ways. They're not six alternative philosophies, they're six philosophies which blend together to give a complete picture of the whole. And of those, Sankhya is the oldest. So the school of philosophy that we're studying tonight was founded sometime prior to written history. It was written down later. And all of the texts that remain are all later texts written down between, say, 300 AD and even 1700, 1800 AD. But prior to that, there was a long school of philosophy called Sankhya. And that school of philosophy was initiated by a teacher whose name was Kapila. K-A-P-I-L-A, Kapila. Kapila is a legendary figure. In some cases, he's described as the infinite embodied. But in other cases, his name and his mother and his father are given. When his father went off to study meditation in the forest, he became his mother's teacher, and the two of them actually were enlightened. I don't know what happened to the father, actually, after that. So there are intriguing stories about Kapila in ancient times. But the story that we're trying to tell is something more about what his teaching embraced. And it's a teaching that is a practical teaching. It's easy for us sometimes, if we've read a little bit of Indian philosophy, to imagine that we are all one, that if we are quiet and good, we will know that for certain next week, but for now, we're going to go on faith that we are all one. That's not exactly how Kapila presented it. He said the reality is that we may all be one, but we don't really know it. We see one another and we compare one another's bank accounts and one another's cars and one another's houses and one another's who knows what. And realize that for the most part, we see one another as separate from one another, not one. And Kapila was quick to say, that's not a bad idea, because in embracing a reality like that, it gives us a chance to think about life as it is, not as we imagine it to be. So Kapila began with this idea that it's not exactly true that we are all one, but if not, what are we? And that's where these six schools of Indian philosophy begin to differ from one another. Just to list them so you hear the names. You don't have to write them or anything like that, but just to hear the names. The philosophical schools are Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Sankhya, Yoga, Mimamsa, and Vedanta. Of those, Nyasa is a school of logic. It's interested in knowing how you know anything for certain. So it has an epistemological ring to it. Epistemology means, how do you know what you know? And if I say that, gee, you have a lovely green sweater on, that may or may not be true, depending on my perception of green. If I say, you have a lovely green sweater on, definitely you don't. So how did I think that it was green when it's definitely not green? It's beige or something like that. It's because my senses registered the information and I presented it in an inaccurate way. So I want to know how you know when you're correct. And that kind of knowledge is partly given by inference. That is, there's smoke on the hill. Where there is smoke, there is fire. So each time I make some statement about life, I have to be sure that what I state is relatively true. That's the purpose of Nyaya philosophy. Vaisheshika philosophy was an effort to describe the universe in terms of what it seems like to the scientists of that period. Vaisheshika is hardly ever given much attention these days, but it was an interesting philosophy, or it was an interesting first attempt at an atomic theory, which is where we are now. The third school is Sankhya, we'll come back to it. The fourth school is Yoga. It's allied with the Sankhya system, and one of the reasons for studying Sankhya is because it prepares you to practice yoga, gives you a vocabulary, and provides concepts. So we'll come back to it. The yoga system, although we do think we know yoga, we think of yoga as postures mainly. From the point of view that we're studying tonight, postures is a very small part of the bigger picture. Yoga is really a picture about knowing oneself. And in knowing oneself, one needs to meditate. So there is a meditative theme that runs through all of this work that we're doing. Then, Mimamsa. Mimamsa is an interesting school, also not so highly practiced these days, but it's a school defining how to perform ritual. And it was at one time a very, very important school because everyone felt it necessary to perform rituals every day. I still wonder. I wake up in the morning. When I wake up, I fold my legs on the edge of the bed and look out over the bedroom. I have begun to wonder, why in the world do I do that? I don't really do anything, no prayers. I don't say anything particular. I've tried saying some prayers. I've learned some. Oh, Lord, here I am sitting on the edge of the bed. And never really goes anywhere. I never know what to do with that. But I'm thinking that if I were a Mimamsa school person, I'd have some written prayer or something to say when I'm sitting there on the edge of the bed, preparing to get off into the day. Finally, Vedanta. Vedanta is that non-dualist school, and it was expounded by a great teacher whose name is Shankaracharya, who lived in around the 8th century AD. We're not going that far with our teaching because we need to go back and pick up some terms and themes. But you get the idea. This is a big system of philosophy, not a small one, with many people contributing to the overall picture. Sorry, but I had to write a few thoughts down on the computer, and I don't know if it's legal to do this, but I'm doing it. The first extant text of Sankhya was written by a sage whose name was Ishvara Krishna. Ishvara Krishna lived between the 3rd and the 5th century AD, and he wrote a text called the Sankhya Karaka, the work on Sankhya. What he said in that text was interesting. He said he is offering 70 verses on Sankhya. I can read this, in fact. Sankhya Karaka is one of the important texts remaining on Sankhya. He says, I thought someplace he gave the full list. Says someplace that he takes these 70 verses from 70,000 verses written by his predecessor. And so he's left out the stories, which seems awfully too bad, because this book needs some stories. But he left them all out, and what's remaining is just 70 verses. That's it, 70 verses to describe a complete philosophy. And so he begins the text in an important way. He starts out by saying, and I want to read it to you so you can hear the language, because then you'll appreciate the challenge for us all. Because of the torment of the threefold suffering, there arises the desire to know the means of counteracting it. If it is said that this desire, that is, to eliminate suffering, is useless because perceptible means of removal are available, we say, no, since perceptible means are not final or abiding. So what is he saying? He's saying, first of all, there are three kinds of suffering that we all experience. One comes because of our own individual suffering. As I passed the 65 barrier recently, not even that recently, I started thinking, things happen to you when you get older. And those things that happen are part of that suffering, which occur from simply being a person, that's all. There are other kinds of suffering. We run out of gas in the gas tank. Somebody was telling me, Pandit Rajmani, the head of the institute, was telling me that the first trip he took from the institute off to New York City, the person who was driving him was so nervous they forgot to check the gas. They ran out of gas halfway in a freezing cold night. They had to go to a farmyard, knock on the door. Suffering. Things happen in life. So there are things that happen from within our own lives. Then there are things perpetrated on us by others. And finally, there are things which are so big that they are almost universal. Dinosaurs apparently surrendered to a comet, so, or an asteroid. And if that's the case, then those poor fellows, they could have had a long life except for the disaster that happened to them. And that disaster didn't happen to one or two dinosaurs. The whole lot of them wiped out. So because of the torment of the threefold suffering, mine, that brought on me, and that happens to us all, there arises the desire to know the means of counteracting it. That's the fundamental question of Sankhya Yoga. How is it possible to overcome distress, sorrow, pain? And how can one do that, not just temporarily, but deeply and in an enduring way? So that's the starting point. Ishvara Krishna writes the answer to that question briefly. So right in the beginning of the text, he says, this is how you do it. You discriminate between who you are and who you are not. That's his fundamental idea, that somehow we all must at some point in our lives learn to discriminate what we are and what we are not. And if we can truly begin to discriminate that, we will discover that the deep joy of our lives abides inside us, not outside. So the great problem in life is to think that happiness consists only of what we find outside. It's also a great unhappiness, however, to think that there's no happiness. And that's not what this text says. This text does say that there's great happiness in life. In fact, we're going to discover that the purpose of life is to provide happiness. Big statement. We just haven't quite got that far yet. So far, we're still at the point of saying that our study of ourself is marred by the sorrow that we do experience and uncertain about how to discriminate in such a way that we go beyond that sorrow. We need to draw a little bit of a map. And that map starts with a word. Purusha. P-U-R-U-S-H-A. Purusha. The word Purusha means self. And the implication is that you are a Purusha, you are a Purusha, you are a Purusha, each of us is a Purusha. Each of us, that is, has a pure identity, self, a self. And that Purusha is not entirely clear about itself. It's gotten mixed up in the world in both good ways and not so good ways. And so as the result of that getting mixed up, myself becomes entangled with something called Prakriti. Prakriti means the foremost creator, the one who can create anything. Can you just imagine creating your life or my life? Prakriti has it down completely. And Prakriti has figured out how to create any life that's necessary. Prakriti makes it happen. So how do the lives that we've experienced, how do they come about? What makes Prakriti do for us what seems very unlikely and improbable? Well, Prakriti sees that there are some driving forces deep within us that need to be realized, need to be experienced. Some painful, some not so painful. And Prakriti provides the potential for that. Therefore, Prakriti is herself. That's not going to work. Prakriti is herself unmanifest. But she manifests. Let me put that down in a moment. She manifests in all of us and in this world as well. So the whole idea of Prakriti is that there is a natural force in life and in the world which carries out the instructions that are sort of DNA'd, embedded in all our lives, and carries them out in such a way that we also have a common life. It's not just each individual person working out their own stuff. But we all share in this common life as well. And so Prakriti is unmanifest, but she manifests in the form of, the first form is called Mahat. And from Mahat on, we can say that the world manifests itself. That manifestation, beginning with Mahat, the word Mahat means great. That is the great self, the one in which the entire energy of this universe, not all universes, but this universe is embodied. And it's embodied in the form of something like I. That's it. Not even I am, just simply I. And there is a me. There is a you. There is a being within all of us that can simply say I. That being wants to add to it. Just simply saying I doesn't seem really quite complete. And so Mahat takes on a little bit more of an identity. It says, I am. So not simply I, but I am. And ahamkara, the word aham has the English word I as its meaning. Kara means to make. So the one that makes me think that I am is the ahamkara. And all of us have an ahamkara. All of us have a self-identity. And we know who we are. We also hope that we will last forever, don't you? Not the bad stuff. The bad stuff we're going to use yoga to overcome. But the good stuff, I'd just like to hang around forever. So ahamkara anyway, has this sort of fanciful notion that maybe it could happen for me. It hasn't happened for anybody else yet, but I might be the first. And with that ahamkara, I begin to think about possibilities. And here's the first possibility. Give me a mind. I'd like to have a mind. That mind is the place where I'm going to experience life, so make it a really crystal clear one and not messed up by too many confusions. Look around the room, for example, and you'll see an enormous display of colors and shapes, sizes of things. All of that is seen on a screen called mind. And that screen, Sanskrit word for it is manas, M-A-N-A-S. That screen presents information to us mainly when our eyes are open anyway, from the outside. But it has the capacity to receive information from inside as well. And the sutras of Ishvara Krishna say it pretty clearly, that when the mind is engaged with the senses, then mahat, ahamkara, and manas, they all naturally work together to discover the experience that the sense provides. So, see this marker? What color is it? You've got a red marker in front of you and you know it. So that red marker now becomes a definite something for you. You perceive it. But if I ask you to close your eyes, you don't even have to do it, but if I were to ask you to close your eyes and then say, what color is the marker? You'd say, well, I think it was red. If I switched markers on you, it'd be a nasty trick. But you can see that the color of the marker now doesn't depend on your sense. It depends on your memory. So, ahamkara, there's an implication that when we get to the level of mind, we can also remember. We'll have to draw that in a little bit. On the other hand, ahamkara has another direction to move in, and this is where it gets awkward. There are five somethings called tanmatras, merest essences of things, smellability. So what is it that has the capacity to smell? That is, to have an odor or to have a smell. That's earth. What is it that has the capacity to provide a taste? That's water. And so it is that there are five elements: earth, water, fire, air, and space. All of them the product of these five tanmatras, subtle essences. If you go over to the other side and you look at the mind, there are also five senses called cognitive senses, and five senses called active senses, and they're connected to the mind. The cognitive senses you know very well, taste, touch, sight, smell, and hearing. And the active senses you may not know so well, manipulation, locomotion, elimination of wastes from your body, procreation, and speech. So there are 10 senses, plus mind, the 11th sense. And if it's a sense, there has to be an object. So if hearing is the sense, then sound is the object. Smelling is the sense, then... No, if air is the sense... If touch is the sense, then air is the object. So, in that way, there are 10 senses, plus there is an 11th sense. Manas itself is considered to be a sense. And manas is that sense which has for its object imagination. Think about it for a moment, because now we're starting to get close to meditation. If we were to just simply sit down, close our eyes, and be quiet for a little while, we'd find that it's imagination that wakes up. And in our imagination, we see ourselves doing this, or feeling that, or having that experience. And in all of the experiences we have in meditation, the energy behind that imagination is usually something we want or something we don't want. And so it is that the experience of having a mind and then quieting those senses so that we can experience the mind in itself, it brings us again back to the experience of memory. What is it that comes up in us because it's either close to the surface or far from the surface, but of interest to us, of emotional interest to us? So that's what we're going to do for a moment, is stop and see if we can reconnect with that experience. So if you sit back in your chair and be as comfortable as you can be. Sit back, be comfortable, close your eyes. Now the thing is, if you do this for 1 minute, it's probably not going to be long enough. Because in 1 minute, memories and fantasies, desires and wants and wishes will continue to come up. So the best thing to do to get started is to be as comfortable as possible. Use the back of the chair to support you. Soften the way you hold your body and let the weight of your body settle down on the chair. Let the chair hold you. So you relax the way you hold your body, and you let the chair hold you. Almost at the same time, you'll become aware of your breathing. Feel the exhalation, feel the inhalation. Gradually you'll sense that your desire to walk or talk, your desire to move about with your hands, even your desire to take in much more information, it all kind of quiets down. it might be replaced by a feeling of breathing. The exhalation cleanses, the inhalation nourishes you. As you continue following the flow of your breathing, let the breath begin to flow at just the right pace for you. It's not too fast, but it's also not too slow. So that in a sense, there's nothing more to be done by you. Your body rests, your breath flows, and you become something like a watcher. You see those flashes of imagination that pass through your mind. And you sense the pleasantness of meditating. Maintain the relaxed flow of your breathing. Give your mind an object, a focus. Use the sound soham, so that your mind no longer needs to think about any other particular thing, but just has the opportunity to rest. Inhale so, exhale hum. Relax your body, relax your breathing, relax your mind. And you will sense your own self, your own sense of I. Om. Peace, peace, peace. Now just slowly start to bring your awareness back out again. And you can stretch a bit if you like. Before I organized this talk, I ran into an article on the Yoga International website. Do you know the website? YogaInternational.com. And have any of you read the article on the headstand, shoulder stand? A couple of people, not many. Really interesting article. It's an article in which the author says that he is a partner in a yoga studio in Toronto, And in this yoga studio, the owner of the studio recently put up notice asking the students of that studio not to try to learn the headstand or the shoulder stand or even to practice them whatsoever in the studio itself. And apparently the students in that studio had been aware enough that that was a theme going on, that they didn't mind too much. But in the bigger context of the web, there were lots of reactions. And so there was an article in yogainternational.com describing what those reactions were and giving some attention to them. So among the reasons that the person who owned the studio gave for not wanting the headstand in her studio was that there hadn't been really enough medical support for practice that it really made sense to her to do it. That was one thing. And another thing was that she herself had had some injuries from doing the headstand, and she thought if she, a very experienced yoga teacher, hadn't been able to handle it too well, that maybe others who were much less experienced would have difficulty as well. And then she thought also, when you get people sitting around doing headstands that are unsupervised, pretty much it's a way of bragging. And she thought it might be better not to have people bragging about what they could or couldn't do in her studio. So she asked him not to do it. And she also wondered whether the people who were recommending the headstand really were doing it on the basis of some true knowledge. Remember our question, how do you know what's true or not? Some true knowledge or not. And she named some pretty well-known, not just pretty, very well-known teachers who had described doing the headstand in ways that probably would lead to some injuries for many people. Then, more than that, she also said, what was the last method, last thing? That since most of us in North America walk around with our heads forward like this, we are likely to do our headstands in the same way. And in that case, the weight of the body leans toward the front of the spine and you'd create problems down the road. The truth is, all of those comments are true. And so the question was, however, is that the end of the story? Just everybody puts up a notice, no more headstands. Or is there some other aspect? And incidentally, I haven't told anybody in Buffalo I was going to say this, so if you're doing headstands here, think it through, and you read the article and think it through. But the whole idea then was to take a deeper look at what makes something true. Is it true just because someone says it? Is it true because an authority says it? Is the authority needing to have some experience behind there what they say or not? All of those things were questions that were raised by the article. If he had wanted to, he could have also gone to Sankhya philosophy and he could have said, what are the reasons for thinking something is true based on the Sankhya yoga system of philosophy? Because that might provide us with some insight about whether we should be doing headstands or not. In fact, it could tell us something about what kind of car to drive and what kind of meals to eat and whether you should do this or not do this in your life. And lots of things could eventually become part of your self-discovery if you begin to think about three things. Do I know it myself directly? Can I infer it because everybody else is doing it? And if not, can I trust the advice of somebody who I respect? And there are times when any of those three might become important tools for us in knowing whether something is true or not. So I'm going to just suggest, go to yogainternational.com, get a free membership. They're free. Read the whole article. You might not even have to get a membership to read the article. Just go there and see what you can get. But read the article and think through the question, is this testimony, is this inference, or is this knowledge direct from somebody who's writing or speaking? And it'll open up a whole new world, actually, for you. And particularly, it's nice to do it in regard to yoga, because that's where the ideas come from in the first place. Okay, how did the meditation go? The interesting thing that happens when you meditate, and we're going to look at this tomorrow morning more carefully, is that meditation does, for some reason, open up imagination. It's like when I sit and I quiet myself, I don't really have to do anything. Imagination just springs forward into my mind and I see this thought, this experience, or an idea. And then that raises the question for us, what should I do with it? Here I am meditating, and I thought that you were supposed to be not having these kind of thoughts in meditation. But I'm meditating, and I have them every time I meditate. So what do I do with those kind of thoughts? How do I let them lead me to something higher in my life? And so for the moment, we can answer the question that if you have a body and you're going to meditate, you don't want to get rid of your body. You want to make it comfortable. If you have a breath and you meditate, you don't want to stop breathing. You want to let your breath become absolutely comfortable. But then we get to the mind and we say, but when you're meditating in your mind, you want to get rid of those cotton-picking thoughts. And it maybe is not ever going to work out. It seems to be the case that this mahat, which has the individual name of buddhi, B-U-D-D-H-I, is meant to look at the experience we have in life and to measure it so that we can come away from meditation practice not only feeling refreshed, but also feeling wiser. And there are two ways in which the buddhi measures. So I'm going to make this go away. The first way that the buddhi measures is through three things called the three gunas. One is sattva, rajas, and tamas. That self living within us, the purusha, is what we would like to know. We have a goal in yoga, in meditation. We would like to know that inner self and know it in such a relaxed and pleasant way that the text says something like this, that it's like the milk of a cow given to the calf. The cow doesn't stop and think, well, should I give milk to this calf? It just flows out. So that feeling of being just, yes, I am absolutely at peace with myself. And it flows, that peacefulness just flows out of me. That idea is the idea of the purusha. So purusha is restful in its own nature. How could I know that? How could I experience even just a little bit of it in my meditation practice so that my day is filled with it? I don't have to perfect the method yet, but I would little by little gradually like to have that sense of restfulness and peacefulness in me. So one measure then is to measure how things are going according to the three gunas. There's a scripture called the Bhagavad Gita. And in that scripture, there's one verse that kind of captures the difficulty of this. It says that sometimes when you are trying to capture your own peaceful understanding of things, it's as easy and simple as blowing smoke off a fire. You just go like that. The smoke goes away and the fire blazes up. So in that sense, I find the peace of Purusha, quietness inside myself, with hardly any effort at all. That effortless understanding is called sattva. It's revealing of myself. So when I have a really, really nice meditation, that pleasant meditation is usually an experience accompanied by sattvic experience. Sattva is clear and pure and easy. But there are meditations which are not nearly so easy as that. You have to get in and scrub a little bit. And what are you scrubbing? This thought, that imagination. Sometimes you even scrub a little bit or a lot, and it doesn't seem to clear all that well, but at least you know that there's a scrubbing process going on. That kind of work is called rajas. And it's a little bit like dust on a mirror. You have to take a mirror, a cloth, and really scrub that thing to get the mirror clear. But once it's clear, your self-image shines in it. Then there's a third layer of scrubbing. That's not scrubbing at all. It's patiently waiting. That patient waiting is symbolized by a pregnant woman who really has to simply wait. You don't get the benefit of your practice immediately. It takes 9 months. And then things turn out. In a sense, that's tamasic, although we're kind of misleading ourselves here. Sattva, rajas, and tamas are more properly defined as sattva, that which reveals the truth. Rajas, or tamas, that which conceals the truth. And rajas, that which motivates you one way or the other. So suppose that I love headstands. I read that article, it's a bunch of crap. Don't believe it. I love headstands. And why do I love headstands? Because I'm a heroic headstander. Nobody does headstands like me. Do I care whether anybody's going to talk about the cerebral vertebrae? What's a vertebra, I say? So I just go ahead and do my practice because I like it and want it. So what sort of experience or motivation is that? Rajasic experience. I'm motivated in order to propagate the great me. If I'm observing in meditation, I might catch a glimpse of it. Not if I'm pushing all my thoughts away, not if I'm saying that every thought that comes into my mind, don't pay attention, push it on. That isn't going to help me learn much about myself. But on the other hand, if I don't give my mind some clear directive, some clear object for focusing, that also won't help much because nothing is revealed. I'm just chasing after thoughts then in that case. So what I'd like to do is to find some middle ground. First of all, room to know the thoughts that arise in my own mind. And secondly, a time when I bring my attention to a focus and rest there. Knowing those things and going back and forth is part of the skill of meditation. But sattva, rajas, and tamas help me understand what it feels like. Sattvic thing experiences feel light, easy. There are times when my meditation seems so sattvic. Then there are other times when it's not sattvic at all. I find myself busy thinking this thought and that thought, and if I manage to squeak out a few moments of attention, that's the best I am going to get in this meditation. That's a rajasic experience, driving me toward distractedness. And then there are those meditations when I fall asleep. That's all there is to it. Nothing gets revealed at all because I haven't been able to maintain consciousness for more than a few minutes. That kind of experience is tamasic. who in me knows the difference? Well, I have to train myself. If I don't do a little self-training, I won't know the difference at all. So I have to meditate with some idea that my meditation involves training myself to recognize when thoughts are light and easily focused, when they're not, and what drives me one way or the other. So there's some practice. That's why when we talk about meditation, we talked about it as my practice, because I need to do the practice in such a way that I see myself. Now, there is another set of criteria. And actually, the truth is, there are more than these that I'm telling you. So you can come back next Thursday and we'll complete the list. But in the Sankhya system, they describe it both as a system of gunas and also as a system of bhava, bhavas. Here are the bhavas. First one is dharma. Dharma means virtue. Second one is jnana, knowledge. The third one is, let's skip to the fourth one. I'll come back to the third one. Aishvarya, sorry. Aishvarya. Aishvarya means power or capable. And this one is Dharma, Jnana, Aishvarya. Viraga. Non-attachment. So the text, Ishvara Krishna's text, says that these four are the sattvic ahamkara. And the opposite of these four are the tamasic ahamkara. And that's what shines in the buddhi. Whoops, not ahamkara, sorry. Sorry. Buddhi. So we've got a bunch of Sanskrit terms now. I hope not too many. But if you go back to your map, remember that the mahat is the first merest sense of I. That mahat in an individual like you and me becomes something called the buddhi. And in that sense of the buddhi, I have a merest sense of I. That is, what happens to me in my life reflects in my mind. And I see it, and in my heart, I feel that that was a very good thing to do, I say. I should do that again. Very virtuous. When I do things which are very virtuous, I feel uplifted by what I've done. Life is good. On the other hand, there are times when I know that it's really definitely not a virtuous thing to do, but I think I'll do it anyway. And why do I do it anyway? Because I think it's going to make me happy. That is, it will help me overcome my suffering. And all of us, there's no one who doesn't stare straight at non-virtuous things in our life and go ahead and do them anyway. It takes time for us to sort it out. We have to get some experience and see how deeply embedded is it. Is it smoke on a fire? Is it dust on a mirror? Or is it a pregnancy that's going to take some time to work out here? So those are the very things. Here in this system of bhavas, there are said to be eight. There's dharma, jnana, viraga, and aishwarya. And there's adharma, ajnana, avairagya, or raga, and unaishwarya. So let's just talk about them for a moment. Dharma, virtue. There's virtue in doing what is yours to do in your life. That's all. If you see it right in front of you and it's yours to do, then when you meditate, your inner heart is going to be saying to you, do you remember that thing that is yours to do? Well, get up and do it. Or when the meditation is over, keep it in mind. Don't forget it. And so we do run into virtue, and we run into non-virtue. And that's part of life. No one is ever saying that a person becomes a bad person merely because they've done an unvirtuous thing in their life. It's that when we mistake virtue from non-virtue, then that creates the problem for us. So we need to try to see what it is that's wise and gradually over time move ourselves in that direction. Or if not moving in that direction, at least turn to face it. Face what's wise. Even if you don't move much, at least you see it from here. And so meditation really becomes a wonderful door opening. Knowledge. Knowledge of what? Knowledge of Purusha. Now, how would I know, how would the buddhi ever figure out that there's something to be known called Purusha? It helps to have studied a little bit of Sankhya philosophy. That's why they all say that a little of the vocabulary is going to go a long ways. So I have some philosophy that knowledge means knowledge of Purusha. But why don't I know the Purusha anyway? If it's my own natural self, I should know it by now. The answer that the philosophy gives is that that self is easily mistaken for what is not the self. That self, Purusha, is not subject to the play of the three gunas, Sotva, Rajas, and Tamas. It's absolutely pure, wise, and free. So if anything, when I'm sitting for meditation and I find my mind carried away by imagination, I must not be talking about knowledge of the self. If, on the other hand, I sit and I rest, and my attention really is absorbed in its resting place, then the experience I have of the self in me is not an experience of a thing, but an experience of being, an experience of consciousness itself. So Purusha is that experience which we know of as light or consciousness or being. And that Purusha is wise, pure, and free. That's the knowledge gained through jnana. Viraga, or sometimes written vairagya, is the experience in which my life is overwhelmed by what I want and I can't turn away from it no matter what. Vairagya is just the opposite, that my life is not overwhelmed by what I want and I choose how much and when to want it. Aishwarya, power, capability. The idea of Aishwarya is that an obstacle that gets in my way is easily dispatched by someone who is powerful. But for someone who lacks power, the obstacle gets in my way and I feel stuck and overwhelmed by that obstacle. The eight different bhavas all are important to be observed from the point of view of buddhi, but only one of them, jnana, provides for liberation, and that's knowledge of the self. So, we're getting a little closer now to the end of a story. The end of the story is that life is an ongoing experience, and in my meditation practice, I see that ongoing experience of life as something rich and worth studying. who is it that's giving experience any kind of logical play in me? What keeps me thinking that life is going to work out for me? Even when it has had some rough times, I still think life is going to work out for me. And if not today, definitely tomorrow or the next day, it will work out. So why is it that I have that confidence in me? The Sankhya philosophy offers an amazing set of verses that I'd like to read to you. It says, starts out by saying, the Purusha, which is consciousness, that's this Purusha, which is consciousness, attains suffering made by decay and death, until deliverance of the subtle body. Therefore, suffering is of the nature of things. Let me read it again. The Purusha, which is consciousness, attains there. Where is there? In life. Attains in life the suffering made by decay and death. That is, everybody gets older and everybody has to look at the face of death. Therefore, suffering is of the nature of all things. Nothing avoids that. One time, we were talking about that. There's a mantra, many of you know, Mahamrityunjaya mantra. It's the great death-conquering mantra. And Pandit Rajmani was giving a lecture, laughing and laughing, saying, do you know anybody who's used that mantra to conquer death? Nobody ever conquers death by just saying the mantra. It's the fear of death-conquering mantra that mantra is all about. So the Purusha, which is consciousness, attains in life that suffering made by decay and death until deliverance of the subtle body. What in the world is the subtle body? Buddhi, ahamkara, manas, and the 10 senses. That's the subtle body. And once those things are fully satisfied in themselves, then Purusha is free. But until then, stuck. But now it goes on and it says, this creation of life brought about by Prakriti from the great one, Mahat, down to the specific gross elements, that is earth, water, fire, air, space, functions for the sake of the release of each Purusha. This is done for the sake of another, as if it were for her own benefit. Let me read this again and you'll get it. This creation, this world and this life, is brought about by Prakriti. Prakriti is nature. From the Great One, Mahat, that first, nearest sense of I, down to the specific gross elements, earth, water, fire, air, and space, Prakriti functions for the sake of the release of Purusha. This is done for the sake of another. What is this? This is done. Prakriti provides us with life so that we ourselves can be released. She has no particular needs of her own. She is capable of creating every situation and every life, but she has no particular need of her own except for one, and that is for each of us to be free. Amazing thing. That life is for us, not for someone else. Life is us. And it's not just some life, but every life. The very one that you and I are leading, that life is provided to us by Prakriti, not for her sake, not for some other one's sake, but for our own sake. It goes on, it says, as the knowing or unconscious milk functions for the sake of the nourishment of the calf, so Prakriti functions for the sake of the release of the Purusha. Instinctively, just in the same way that a cow begins to give milk for its calf, Prakriti is immediately drawn to helping, to giving release to each of us. As in the world, a person engages in actions for the sake of the cessation of a desire, so also does the Prakriti function for the sake of the release of the Purusha. So it goes on, he just keeps saying more and more. He says, in the same way that each of us naturally acts in order to get what we think will give us happiness, our desire, Prakriti has one desire, and that is the release from suffering. As a dancer ceases from the dance after having been seen by the audience, so also Prakriti ceases after having manifested herself to the Purusha. So once I really see jnana, once I really have knowledge of the Purusha, Prakriti says, that's it, I'm done. Don't have any more things to worry about, so I'm leaving. You've seen the dancer and she's me. On the other hand, she, Prakriti, possessed of the gunas, so now they're taking it from the other point of view, not just the eight bhavas, but now the three gunas. But on the other hand, possessed of the gunas and helpful in various ways. You think of ways in which life seems to have helped you occasionally. I can remember when I was a child, I can just very vaguely remember standing at the front door listening to see if my mother was coming home. And if she was coming home, my brother and I were going to head off to bed really, really quick. And I always worried that maybe we would have dropped something or given some clue that, you know, we were up, but somehow the universe was on our side in those ways. So she, possessed of the gunas and helpful in various ways, behaves selflessly for the sake of Purusha, who is without the gunas and who plays no helpful part. Still more, no one therefore is bound, no one released. Likewise, no one really transmigrates. Only Prakriti in its various forms transmigrates, is bound, and then is released. Why do I think that I'm transmigrating? Who knows what transmigrating is? Why do I think that I'm dying and living, and who knows what I'm doing, going through in the meantime? I think that way because that's how I identify myself. I strongly identify. When I meditate, however, I don't think that way. At least for a moment in my meditation practice, I sit quietly thinking, that stuff passing through the screen of my mind is not me. It's a version of my own Prakriti. And she is there to help me, not to harm me. So what I see in meditation is really not my enemy, not something to be struggled against, but instead something to be recognized as my friend and helper, and also something to be taken seriously. Because if I'm going to recognize the means for relieving pain, I need to also occasionally know how to change myself, to listen to my own inner heart and make changes that are necessary in life. So, Prakriti binds herself by herself by means of seven forms. Remember, we talked about the three gunas. This says Prakriti binds herself by herself, that is, on her own initiative, she doesn't have to be asked by us. Binds herself by means of seven forms or bhava. This one, this one, this one, and the four opposites make seven. One bhava, knowledge, is the means for freedom. So she says, this says, Prakriti binds herself by means of seven forms, bhavas. She releases herself by means of one form, for the sake of every Purusha. Thus, from the study or analysis of the principles, the knowledge arises, I am not conscious. Consciousness does not belong to me. The I is not conscious, and this knowledge is complete because it's free from error, pure and solitary. So if you remember, we were talking earlier about how do you know what you know. Now we've gotten to a sutra in which the sutra is claiming to know what it started out saying it knew. It started out saying it knew how to relieve the threefold suffering. Now, he says, thus from the study of the principles are mahat, ahamkara, manas, ten senses, tanmatras, and the five gross elements. Those are the tattvas. Thus from the study of those arises the thought, I am not conscious. Now how, sounds like we've entered into a whole nother thing here. But I am not conscious means I am not conscious. What is conscious? Purusha is conscious, yeah. I am not conscious. Consciousness does not belong to me. The I is not conscious, and this knowledge is complete because it's free from error, pure and solitary. Then the Purusha, comfortably situated like a spectator, sees Prakriti, whose activity has ceased due to the completion of her purpose, and who has turned back from those seven forms. That Purusha says, indifferent one or spectator, I have seen her. The other ceases, saying, I have been seen. Through the two, though the two are still in proximity, no further creation takes place. Let's see if there's one more sentence. This secret or mysterious knowledge, for the sake of the Purusha, wherein is analyzed the existence, origin, and termination of all beings, has been expounded or enumerated by the highest or greatest sage. That highest or greatest sage is Kapila, according to the author of this book. This excellent and pure knowledge the sage gave with compassion to Asuri. Asuri, likewise, to Panchashika, and by him the doctrine, Tantra, was expanded or modified. Handed down by disciples in succession, it has been compendiously written in Arya meter by the noble-minded Ishvara Krishna, the author of this text, having fully learned the demonstrated truth. So he is saying, it's not inference, it's not testimony. I saw it. I know it, he says. And with that, he brings his own text to a conclusion. So what we've seen is just a quick flashing overview of a philosophy that has these major points. That it says that at least in the life that we live, we can't just simply say we are all one, but that there are two, Purusha and Prakriti. That ultimately, at the end, it turns out that Prakriti is entirely serving Purusha in order to lift that Purusha, each of us, up and give us a sense that we are the spectator, the witness, the inner being, the inner watcher, and that we ultimately find ourselves in the lap of Purusha because we are Purusha. We are consciousness, and our practice is worth doing because it gives us glimpses, gradually expanding, of something much bigger than ourselves. So I think for the moment that's the stopping point. Any thoughts left over? Yeah.
You spoke about imagination in the sense of meditation, and
yeah.
I guess I'm curious as if in that idea of imagination, can there be any, I guess, hidden truth?
Yeah, we have a bogus idea about imagination. We think that imagination is somehow not a good thing to have. But, you know, if you think about it, the benzene ring was developed by imagination. lots of discoveries in our own personal lives are the result of imagination, we wouldn't want to toss imagination out the window. But we also wouldn't want to make it the truth, the foundation of our truth. And we'd have to have right thinking, valid thinking, perception, inference, testimony, and imagination. But we know the truth of imagination only after we've tested it out a little bit. So you should take your imagination, write it down, refine it, see whether it's pulled off or not, and if it is, do it. And if not, come up with a new imagination. Ultimately, the imagination that's really a profound one is the one that grasps at these fundamental core concepts of practice. Those are really great imaginations. Can't you just see yourself under the Bodhi tree, eating the apple that fell? Who knows what you'll be doing, but you will have learned something about yourself.
Meditation, you keep doing it and you go beyond prakriti, right? That's the...
You do, yeah. But for us, the starting point for going beyond prakriti in meditation is you have the feeling that you are the observer. We've all heard it. We maybe haven't grasped the importance of it, but we've heard it. That I'm not the observer, I am the observer, and if I'm the observer, then I'm not the chain of passing thoughts. That's prakriti. So tomorrow morning is the practicum, Saturday morning is the practicum. It's to put what we've just talked about into practice and to do it in such a way that we have some confidence that we can go back and do it again the next day and the next day and the day after that. So we'll try to work out the bugs, and I have some handouts that I'll pass out to you on Saturday so you'll have some worksheets to do it with. In the meantime, if you suddenly have an extraordinary interest in Sankhya philosophy, don't buy this book. It is absolutely way impossible to read. But the one thing you'll notice that all my bookmarks are at the very end of the book, because that's where the text of Ishvara Krishna is. So if you want to have a book that just has it, you could go there, but I think it might be smarter to go online. My guess is it's probably online somewhere. On the other hand, buy these books. Seven Systems of Indian Philosophy is written by Pandit Rajamani Tiganat. It's an overview of six of the systems plus Buddhism. So if you'd like to get a grasp of Indian philosophy, it's there. The relationship between Sankhya as a philosophical system and yoga as a practice is in his first volume called The Secret of the Yoga Sutra. That's in the bookstore, I'm sure. And it just came out. He's working on the second chapter. And he's doing pretty well, actually, better than I was expecting. We were in India together about 2 months ago, and he had brought somebody over from the States to help with dictation and editing the text. There is so much busyness in India that we hardly got anything like that worked on. But in the time that I left India and got back here, about a month passed, and he really did get a lot done. So we might see volume 2 of that book by next spring or fall. We'll see. It'll be great. Thank you all. It's been really nice to spend some time with you and think through this. You'll think through it many times over, I suspect. But I hope it's been helpful.
Thank you.